And now, The Moment with Ryan Koppelman.
There is nothing but the moment. Don't you waste it on regret.
Hey, here's The Moment. I'm Brian Koppelman. Thanks for listening. Warren Light is showing up soon. You may not know his name, but you probably know his work. For the past 3 years, as the showrunner, exec producer, and head writer for Law & Order SVU. Before that, as the general in charge of Law & Order Criminal Intent. Also the great but short-lived series Lights Out, about a heavyweight champ down on his luck who has one more try. And before that, this is where it gets really interesting, before that, as the Tony Award-winning playwright of the very personal memory play Sideman, which is, on the surface, about as far away from the Law & Order procedurals as you can get. He's also written and directed feature films. What's going to be fun about this is that Warren doesn't know he played a big role in my own moment. That is, in my becoming a screenwriter and director. I can't wait to tell him how and why. Warren's also, like me, a lifelong suffering Knicks fan. When I decided to start this podcast, I wrote down a list of guests I wanted. Warren was near the top. Because since I first met him in 1992, I've considered him one of my favorite people to talk to. Because he's wise and funny, and seems to understand the way the world really functions underneath the way it seems to function. And whenever we see one another, it's warm and friendly, and almost immediately falls into the kind of shorthand that good friends fall into. But we've never really hung out, never really become friends. So I've never really gotten to ask him all the stuff I want to. But I will, as soon as he gets here, which should be any minute. So Warren, thanks for being here. This is really exciting and fun for me to get to talk to you in this way. I said when I was introducing you that you and I, we first met, I don't know if you remember when we first met, but we met in 1992. And, but whenever we've seen each other over the years, we immediately sort of fall into a really friendly shorthand.
The reason I came here is I never get to see you. I don't have a social life. And I thought, okay, if I do the podcast, I'll get to see you and we'll get to talk.
Yeah, that's I said, you know, somehow we always are like friends without ever really being friends because we've never really hung out. So this is great. As you know, this show, The Moment, I'm really interested in diving into a big moment in somebody's life, an inflection point where things could really go one way or another. And when you were, how old were you when you made Night We Never Met?
Probably, let's see, I was 92. If I do the math, it looks like 35.
So you're 35 years old, you get to write and direct your first feature. You've written other features, but you get to write a movie. And who was in the film?
Everyone. It was the oddest, it was a kind of a lower budget film, but it was Matthew Broderick, Annabella Sciorra, Kevin Anderson, Christine Baranski, Dominic Chianese, Gary Shandling. It was there were nice little parts for everyone to play, and people, it became, I don't know what happened exactly, but we started just Justine Bateman, who was terrific.
Well, you wrote a really compelling screenplay for people to be in, and it's an odd movie, but it's a time capsule, that movie, in a way, because of those people. But you can feel in that movie the heart in it, and you could. I think that the actors probably responded to that. But what's interesting to me is, you know, you've gone on, and we'll talk about it, to enormous success. But and when you're a 35-year-old living in Manhattan, making a film like that, you're really riding high.
Yeah, I was under the delusion, and you have these delusions from time to time, that this was going to be. It's almost a setup. Every time people say, well, I'll see you at the Emmys next year, that's code for your show's going to be canceled.
Yeah.
After this movie comes out, you'll never have to worry again about money is code for you're about to go through the two lowest income years of your life. It's a phenomenon that, at least in my life, the minute my success is assured, the subtext is you're about to just plummet. You're about to hit a new bottom,
yeah,
a bottom you didn't know was there.
Yeah, you're screwed. I will tell you, Dave and I made a pilot 8-9 years ago, and we screened the pilot, and the screening goes really well. And the guy who runs the studio turns to us as everyone's leaving, and he says, "Tell your families, you're moving to L.A. We're making the show.
Your lives are going to completely change. Pack your boxes. And like 24 hours later is when they said, oh, we're not moving forward with the program. Now, you know, in those 24 hours, I kind of relied upon that representation.
Yeah, no, that I've learned not to do. I've learned to, I mean, it used to always be wait until the check clears. And now I don't even believe that. I have learned never, it's just a hard won lesson. Right? You just don't let your expectations get ahead of the reality or of the future, because people will blow smoke up your ass. And they mean it at that moment. And 4 days later, they will deny knowing you.
Well, yeah, they may even, they don't even mean it. I mean, they believe, they've convinced themselves where
they want to believe it. There is almost a sense of religious fervor to wanting to believe this is the hit. We're going to ride this. We're going to make, this is it. Because, by the way, if it is a hit, they're part of a hit. And they found me and helped create. So we're all, in fact, it's their hit. So in that moment, it's a great, evangelical moment. But this is our moment. And then when you betray them by not having actually created a hit, it can turn on you quickly because they have to distance themselves from you.
They don't want loser juice on them.
No. I had a movie that did disastrously at some point that everyone loved the script of, and again, my life would never be the same. And then Gary Marshall came in and completely screwed it up. And it was a movie that got me a bunch of other work. It was this thing called Dear God, and you have these little periods of heat, and that was one of the first ones, and I didn't know better. And then after the movie came out, I was unemployable, and I was putting myself up for jobs that I just couldn't stand the thought of writing, but I just needed to book something, and I wasn't getting those jobs. I was like lowering myself as fast as I could, and I was getting turned down. And someone said, I said, what's going on? A friend of mine said, well, Dear God came out. And I said, but everyone loved that script. And he goes, until it came out. He said, you're in movie prison.
Yeah, movie jail.
And I didn't know that was the first I'd heard the term. And I said, well, but everyone loved the script. I didn't do it. He goes, every writer in movie jail is there for a crime he swears he didn't commit.
That's a great line. No. Well, the thing that you have to learn as a screenwriter is you book the next job as your movie's coming out, not after, right? You want to sell on the news,
sell before the news.
Okay, right before the news. So that's a lesson we learned kind of early on, Dave and I, from agent said to us when he was trying to sign us from another agency.
I miss that one because I actually usually by the time something like that gets going, I'm so tired. I just want to lay out for a little while. I don't have that layout gear doesn't exist in my television life anymore. But when I was a freelance writer, I think, man, that was a lot of work. Let me just, I should have, like, going back tonight, We Never Met. There was a lot of buzz before that movie came out, and I went away for 6 weeks.
Oh, you did? You left?
Yeah, I left town. I didn't want to go to, I was just, it was a lot of sort of ugly back and forth with the always formidable Harvey Weinstein. And I was just kind of wiped out from the brutality of that editing process with him. And I just thought, this will be fine. Everyone, once this comes out, I'll go to L.A. And
bask in it, basically.
Embarrassingly enough.
Right.
I didn't understand.
They'll meet you at the airport with a sign, Mr. Light.
Mr. Light, there'll be several people with signs, and I get to choose which car I want to go. Obviously, in hindsight, it seems delusional. It seems like.
But it's a repeatable delusion.
Yeah.
Because it's what brings everybody.
It's a casino, right? You see other people hitting, and you have a better hand. And what could possibly go wrong?
So you're there. You've made this movie. You are daydreaming about what the fruits are going to be, and it comes out and it is received poorly.
I would say so. I would say that the reviews were harsh.
They were uncharitable.
And now you get things like one of the more unfairly reviled movies of the 90s.
That always happens.
Yeah, that
the movie's
really
way better
now
than the response. Yeah, helpful to you now, right?
Yeah, I cherish those.
I've had the thing where...
I've had critics come up and apologize to me.
I got to hear... So go ahead.
Yeah, no. A couple of them said, I really blew it on your movie. I was so convinced because, again, going back to Harvey was pushing me to make changes that I wasn't making. So he kept delaying when the critics would come in. And then he decided... Also, Harvey, at that point, Miramax was about to be bought by Disney. So he was in the highest anxiety mode he could possibly be in. If the sale hadn't gone through, I think the whole company would have gone under. I mean, he was in the midst of almost like an AOL Time Warner kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, he had a lot of riding on it, so he didn't want any press about anything. He was just all anxiety. And my movie was going to be the great romantic comedy of all time. It was going to be the next Tootsie. It was going to be the next... And it's like your kid's going to go to Harvard. Your kid's going to be... Wait, before he goes to Harvard, let's get him tutored. Let's get him clothes. Let's get him tennis lessons. Let's get him... Oh, my God, he might not go to Harvard. Let's kill him. And that was almost what happened. He started to turn, and he didn't let anybody see the movie until the days before it opened, because he and I were in a struggle about what the final cut would be. So he kept pushing back the opening for critics. And critics interpret that to mean
they do.
He's burying a bomb. And so they all went in expecting a bomb.
Very hard to defeat those expectations.
He set that up. Odd guy. Not a pleasant man to work with under those circumstances.
And it's funny because, you know, I did have an opposite experience with him, because I made a movie with Harvey where it was the first movie, Rounders, mm-hmm. that we wrote. And he, you know, fought for the movie. It didn't end up doing incredibly well in the beginning, but had this, you know, to me, he's the guy who changed my life. He gave me a career, and then the movie became so important to so many people that I have an undying
stories.
Loyalty to the guy. I've been around him. I've seen them.
Yeah.
And by the way, he's announced that we're making Rounders 2 and that Dave and I are writing it, but he's never, he hasn't called to make us an offer to write it. So I've lived it all. But
yeah.
And so I know your story's true.
No, I had the sort of poisoned mentor experience with him.
Sure.
Other people haven't. I don't know. There were other things going on in his life, and so his anxiety about that was projected onto us.
It's worse when you know there's a guy like that, for you, mm-hmm. an impresario, and you know that if you got the best of them, it could be a life-changing experience in a great way.
For most of my life, I didn't get those guys at that time. I tended to, and you know, after a while, I realized I must be contributing to this. I tended to get the poisoned mentors, the ungenerous guys, the guys who would say, "You're going to write the lyrics, and I'm going to put my name on it," because that's what happened to me when I broke in. I got those guys.
Brutal.
So I had a, you know, a series of difficult work experiences, and his was one of them. But so I've had critics come up and go, you know, we just figured it was, and then I looked at it was on Showtime the other night, 11 years later, and I'm watching it, and we're all enjoying it, and I had no memory of having seen it, and then I realized I'd written a horrible review of it, and it was like, thanks.
Was it satisfying at all?
No, it's like people, you go to a reunion now and people go, you know, I should have dated you in high school.
Well, easy for them to say it now. They see your name on television.
I haven't lost my hair and my name's on TV, and I'm a better bet now than I was at six. People said, you know, you would have been a good bet in high school. You were undervalued. And it's like, thanks so much. Okay.
They wanted to now they want to arbitrage you, but they didn't do it when they should have arbitraged it then.
They want to double down late, you know.
But, you know, see, I've taken a perverse pleasure in it. I, in the beginning, would read every review. And I remember the names of the people and what they wrote. And I've had people who killed Rounders. I mean, Rounders did well and with critics and everything, but there were a few who killed it. And I remember one in particular and why he killed it. And then when Ocean's 13 came out that Dave and I wrote, in his review he wrote, from the guys who wrote the brilliant Rounders.
Yeah, that's confusing.
And I went and dug up. I said to Levine, dude, we've got to get the review because he killed it. But now... You know, and he, of course, has no idea that he caused us this pain.
Yeah, they're like snipers, but like they're like randomly picking people off from balconies.
We can't give them power, though.
Well, they have. Well, interestingly, I think they have less and less power, which makes them more frustrated and angry. And then there are some gorgeous writer critics. You know, I think you look at Alan Sepinwall writing about television can be illuminating to me. I can read his. I can watch
an
episode.
You're no dummy, Nat. You're no dummy.
I mean, well,
name checking Sepinwall.
Well, but he writes. I stumbled on. I didn't know anything about
him.
He's
a great.
I started to read. I guess I was watching Mad Men, and then
his recaps are awesome.
And I didn't. And I was. I just. What did I just see? And I just Googled Mad Men, and I started, and I didn't know who, you know, I didn't know who he was, and I was like, oh, this is an interesting discussion, and I actually would like respond. I was not very, as usual, I backed into television. I've never actually been part of any sort of. I'm not part of the L.A. movie world. I'm not part of a scene in any way. I'm always on the fringe of it.
I mean, I mentioned you've chosen not to be. I want to go back to mm-hmm. one thing, and then I want to talk about that. And you said a bunch of things already. The way you talked even about the way people tell you lies because they're caught up in it. I mean, the liars and people who lie to themselves as a way to lie to you are a huge thing in your work.
Huh.
I mean, if you... Yeah, you can go through your stuff, and often they're noble liars in a way, or people who are telling themselves that they are. But you know, I mean, if you look at your play, and then you know, I mean, you've written a lot of plays, but if you look at your most famous play, there's behavior that's. Not, and if you look at Lights Out, that's a guy who's lying for what he thinks are noble reasons. If you look at the episodes of Criminal Intent and SVU that you've written, mm-hmm. now by nature those shows have lies, but you've chosen a particular kind of liar very often, I think.
I'm interested to learn more about this.
Yeah. Well, we can talk about it, but in Night We Never Met, so the movie comes out,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know...
It flatlines.
Well, it's a bomb and
a success to steam.
and what do you do? Because this led to you having this enormous success a few years later. So, what did you tell yourself in that? You know, I'm kind of really interested in what you told yourself then, and then in what you told yourself after you were a huge success in on Broadway. But what did you tell yourself in the months and in the year and a half or 2 years after that?
I think, first of all, to a degree, I was in denial about it. I didn't understand how it was, how the lack of success for your first directed feature is a, well, let's face it, I haven't directed a feature since then, you know. But I don't think I understood that. I think there really are five stages of, you know, the death of your movie, denial of the death of your movie. And,
yeah.
I probably stayed in denial for a fairly long time. I remember I had a nice little summer rental that year, and I was cooking a lot, and I was just sort of not aware of what was going on. And then, you know, the phone goes cold, and I believe I made less money in the next 2 years than I had since my college job at Jack in the Box. I mean, I made zero money the next year. It was like zero, like... Zero.
What were your agents like when you would talk to them?
They minimized the damage to me, I would say. They were not, they might have been in denial as well.
So they didn't say to you, write a spec script, do something.
No. And I was never, I'm better off, you and I have a different pattern, I suppose, in our work habits. You give me a deadline, something that makes no sense. You give me a messy room that six people have screwed up and we're shooting it in 2 days, fix this. I'll stay up in 2 days and turn it into something. But left alone in my room with the instructions, write whatever you want to write. That's not a good thing for me.
Well, but then how did you, so you're there though, the jobs are, the jobs don't show up. You don't have an idea. What do you do? How do you end up writing this play that changed your life?
Well, I felt a little bit something hadn't worked, and I started to just go, let me go back to what I can control, which is I liked working with actors when I directed them in The Night We Never Met, and I liked, it was my voice. That movie was my voice for, it wasn't something, I couldn't blame it on other people or something like that. It came out of this notion of I can't afford a good apartment in New York. I could probably afford a good apartment for like a day a week or 2 days a week.
That's how Night We Never Met.
Sure. And so it was the notion of people time sharing an apartment because one guy has, Kevin Anderson's the jerk who has the lease. And so it came out of the reality of my sort of barely subsistence living of my 20s and early 30s. So I went back. I was I had been on the fringe of the Naked Angels Theater Company and some other theater companies. I just started doing these little one acts and monologues, and got back into the gym in a sense. And you go to these Tuesday Night at 9 series, or we're putting together an evening of issue one acts, about racism. I go, so I guess we're all against that. And those evenings could be deadly because they were sort of didactic.
Barton Fink theater the working man.
But I was meeting, and that's actually how the cast had come together. I'd met a lot of actors doing this. And I had been noodling for years on being my life as this growing up in the home of a detached jazz musician and a mother who coped with that by becoming increasingly drunk over the years.
Right.
So, but I had done stand up comedy in the 80s about being this, and I had shards of this thing. There was this thing that I had never written that I had been beating myself up for not having written. And I just started to, I started to do more and more pieces about it. I did a little scene about the musicians meeting in a coffee shop. And it was just a kind of a diner scene. And I did a scene, there was one issue project about family. So I did the Thanksgiving dinner at the house that I grew up in.
Right.
Not
knowing these were connected pieces at the time.
Well, I mean, the characters were, I knew who I was writing about, but, and I just started, so the Thanksgiving thing played like gangbusters, and it ends up in the play with Edie Falco screaming, enjoy your lasagna, motherfuckers, at the top of her lungs. And there was nothing else falling into place, so I could noodle with this a little bit. And I had always done stand up at the West Bank, where that's one of those places that's always was I was comfortable going to, and they had these little series, so I was doing things there, West Bank Cafe.
So your confidence wasn't really dinged at the time. Were able to remember that you were good at this or not?
I don't know that I would call it confidence. I never had. There was no. I had no foresight growing up. I had no plan. I had always just booked jobs. I had no goals in life. So I booked this independent movie. I got it made. That was good. And I figured I would. It's hard to explain how unorganized. I grew up in a chaotic home and had absolutely no understanding that everybody around me was thinking about where they would be in 5 years or 10 years, or that you when you meet important people. You don't make fun of them to their face.
The ones you can, then you bond with them for life.
Yes, but in general, they don't like it.
Do you still do it?
I've cut down a lot. An agent said to me, I don't know how to tell you this. There's such a gap between the level at which you write and your political ability to function in the Hollywood world that you're shooting yourself in the foot. A lot. And he said, you can have the thought, you don't have to say it. Which, by the way...
Which is funny because you're so good in a room with your peers.
Yeah, no, I'm and boy am I good with like the PAs, you know?
That right.
But I had a chip about people in authority. I was not raised to respect people in authority. I grew up in one of those really bad neighborhoods in a very bad public school. And the last thing you wanted to be perceived as, and I was 2 years younger than everybody, the last thing you wanted to be was a suck-up or a teacher's pet.
Yeah, but let's say, yeah. I mean, it's funny, you've said this quickly, and it's interesting because I've had a couple of really bright people in here and a couple of them who have, I mean, you just casually mentioned you were 2 years younger than everybody, but I mean, you also, at 2 years younger than everybody else, went to Stanford.
Yeah.
So you were able to figure something out because at 16 you went off to, one of the 3 or 4 best schools in the world. Did you get and were your parents able to pay for that?
No, I was on scholarship. We didn't tell my mother that Stanford was in California until a week before I left.
And your dad had a secret plan.
We had a little secret. I got a scholarship. I only went because I wanted to. I had an image of meeting Peggy Lipton, girls who looked like Peggy. The whole college planning thing. So I was at Fieldston, where I'd also gotten a scholarship. That
right.
school changed my life, absolutely. And that that only happened because the grade school principal called my parents and said, what are your plans for Warren's junior high? And they had none. And she said, his junior high is on 110th and Manhattan Avenue. He's 10 years old. He won't last 6 weeks there. And my parents...
Because was there big racial strife then?
It was
In other
violent.
Words, was
it was
there,
just, I it mean, was, I, it was... School was... the biggest relief that I experienced when I got to Fieldston was I wasn't in fear for my life. Which is a huge relief after public school on 105th Street.
Because you really felt that.
I was getting knocked around routinely, and I had roots. I had a very circumscribed route home, and I would hang out. I made a lot of jokes in the back row with some tough kids who liked that I could be funny. And, you know, it was every day the walk home from school or lunch hour was like you watched Lockdown on MSNBC. It was, now imagine you're 10.
Right. No, I mean, Howard Stern always talks about his childhood being that way and how he had to navigate it.
But he's tall.
Warren's not, just for the sight gag aspect of it. So you got picked to go to private school.
Yeah, she calls my folks up and says, there's a test for private schools. Warren should take it. And my parents are also communists in the middle, and they're like, we don't believe in private school.
Great.
So they said, she said, there's a school, Fieldston, that's very liberal, and they give a lot of scholarships, and let him take the test and just apply. And that, I should have at some point thanked that woman. I never thought to. But it was that moment, if you want to talk about a moment, that was the moment that changed my life, actually.
Do you remember that woman's name?
Mrs. Lois Friedman.
You should write her a little email.
I'm sure she's gone now.
She also
busted me the first time I smoked a cigarette in the boys' bathroom at age 8. She came in.
You're 10 at this time. So when did you skip the two grades? Earlier?
Like kindergarten and third grade. In New York City public schools at that point,
right.
If you were compos mentis, they just, you know.
And by the way, they would judge that by if you knew the phrase compos mentis. That's how they would judge.
Yeah.
So when you were, when you arrived at Fieldston for what grade? Seventh grade?
Mm-hmm.
And was it immediately clear to you, I can do this?
I had no idea where I was. I didn't even know that they had all been in school since preschool. I thought everyone was new. And then I didn't understand why everybody knew everybody. And I
suddenly there are these schools called the Hill Schools that are in the Bronx. But it does the way if you don't know New York, the way you're picturing the Bronx probably isn't what these.
It's Riverdale
are.
And it's They're, Rolling Hills.
I was about to say Rolling Hills. Yeah.
The subway ride up was long, but you got there. I had never been really outdoors, and Fieldston was outdoors, and nobody would visit me because of I lived on 103rd Street, and that was like. Not a place to go to at that time. I thought there were probably other reasons they wouldn't visit either. But so I was completely, and you had I been black or Hispanic, I think people would have understood that I was out of my element more. But if you're
but
not,
because you were a New York Jew, like a Jewish white kid, they assumed that you would understand the signals and signs and rituals.
I remember early on, some kid, I got into it with some kid in the locker room. It was a bigger kid. I guess they all were. At some point, he was teasing me or something. I thought, oh, here comes the beat down. And by that point, I'd learned, like, if it's coming, take the first punch and then, like, roll into a fetal position on the floor or something.
Great strategy.
So, I reached up and I punched him in the mouth and he had braces. And this is, like, in the boys' locker room. And, he got all upset. And everybody was looking. I was like, oh, they don't do this here.
And he was just ranking on you.
Yeah.
And it would have just been...
And I could rank pretty well. But I just thought, I know where this is going. Let's just cut to it. I was just inappropriate. I was almost
How
feral.
Long did it take you to feel like domesticated then if you were feral at the beginning?
It was odd. It was an odd transition because my neighborhood and home life were still were vastly different. So there was just it was a real disconnect. And I had to catch up to people because they had been in the school for 6 years. Right. And I was used to being, this is not a brag, in public school I was the smart kid in school.
I'm sure you were the smart kid in school.
But it took me a while. I was like, they knew things that I didn't know. They were ahead of me. And I wasn't used to not be...
Have you lost that feeling? That they know things you don't know? Have you caught up, do you
Yeah,
think?
Well, I mean, there's things... a lack of... What I call a lack of prenatal foresight is something you can never really do. My life is... so different from the life that my, I have young kids now. It's so different from the life that they're going to grow up with. Or
how old are your kids?
Don't laugh. I started late, 7 and 4.
Did they go to private school?
Yeah. I wouldn't. In fact, we wanted.
We
couldn't get into the public school in our neighborhood because it's so popular. And they suggested a public school in a less good neighborhood that they're trying to kind of get these kids to go to, get to improve the school, whatever. And I that was primal. That's not going to, they're not going there.
So you picked private school.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad that you decided to actually have kids and...
Again, I didn't decide to have...
you
assume planning. I had kids, yes. I have backed into everything in my life for the last, things... I take responsibility as things happen, but I don't. It's not like I didn't think this is the stage of my life where I'm going to do this.
Well, right. So this sense of desperation that you felt, mm-hmm. you were like, and so in the moments when you were now writing these scenes that became Sideman, mm-hmm. you were, and so in the post Night We Never Met thing, actually that sense of outsider status and desperation. That's just how you were.
That felt normal to me. I didn't feel that. It wasn't foreign to me to be feeling excluded
Right. I imagine actually being included. I mean, if you talk about why you have this relationship with these powerful men and can't handle it sometimes, it's because maybe being included is uncomfortable.
Well, I'm not one of them, is my sense of myself, right? So that I was comfortable like writing monologues and. Going to these dingy rooms, and that's seemed simple enough to me. And then I did the one thing I did do. I'd learned about myself. If I give myself a deadline, so I booked a reading of the play at some point.
Oh, that's really smart.
And so I therefore wrote the second act the night before the first reading. Because
how long was the second act?
So I'd say it was about. 40 minutes, 45, an hour,
And you really wrote... you wrote a first draft of it the night before?
I probably put the whole play together. I had these shards going back. There are elements in the play from a short story I wrote in my sophomore year of college. There are shards from all over. But in the 3 days before the workshop came together, I wrote the whole play. And then... we had a very good Edie Falco. Michael Mayer came in to direct. It was at the basement of the West Bank Cafe, and I said he wanted this guy to play my dad, and I had an idea for the mom. I said I'll go with your unemployed actor idea for the dad if you go with my unemployed actress idea for the mom. And it was Edie Falco and Frank Wood.
Right.
4 years later, Frank won the Tony, and Edie would have, but she went to do Sopranos. So. I was nervous the night, so I wrote the play, and then we read it. It was too long, and Michael said to me something like, "Honey, something has to happen in the second act," because I had 30 scenes of ambiance, great flavor. Oh, these guys, these musicians. So I had,
of course,
it was like a night.
Well, it was your whole. I mean, it was you were putting all the stuff that was you witnessed as a child.
It was mine. Yes, it was 40 years of musician stories. I had. Basically grown up with these guys and grown up with a certain kind of dysfunction, and I knew how to depict it, but I had no story or structure.
So you went home, and how did you deal with the guy who said you have to cut this down?
Oh, yeah. So Michael Mayer, we'd read it once, and he's like, well, not only cut it down, he said something has to happen. And I stayed up all night, and around 3 in the morning, something happened. All these things that I, in hindsight, that I'd repressed or forgotten or didn't want to deal with, those were the scenes that had to happen. And I wrote pretty true, disturbing scenes that I probably had never told anyone about these things. The phone call from the police about your mother is on Amsterdam Avenue.
That wasn't in the play that you first read?
No.
Had a reading of?
I didn't. There were certain things. I was protecting my parents from some of the more... I was protecting them. You have to overcome when you're writing something autobiographical. You have to overcome... your fear of what people will think. Now, I didn't think anyone would see the play, so I wasn't too worried about that. But I didn't want to hurt my parents' feelings. I didn't want anyone.
Even
I didn't
as
want
an
them.
Artist.
I didn't want them to think they were bad parents. So I avoided these scenes. But at 3 in the morning, There was the scene of the cops saying, your mom's walking naked on Amsterdam Avenue. There's I wrote the mental institution scene with my mother. And then the scene where I kicked my father out of the apartment.
All that night?
Yeah.
And you just blasted through it. Because in a way, you were, I mean, you, some part of you must have realized, even if you don't plan and all the rest of it, this is my shot.
I guess. I thought, while we're here, and the cast was good. Also, I knew I had Edie and Frank. This is also part of my deal as a writer. If I have the right actors, I can write anything for them. If they're not hearing my rhythms, I block. And it happens to me every week. You know, when I got the right guy, I can write endlessly. They were good. I went home. It was a 2-day. We read the script on day one. We worked on it a little. On day two, we were going to read it one more time. And then there was going to be an audience that night. And I came into Michael at noon. I said, I rewrote act two, like you said. And he's like, what? I said, well, you said to rewrite. And he goes, well, we can't. We're going on tonight. We have to. And I said, well, can we at least hear it? And he said, no, I don't think we have. And I said, well, would you look at it? And then he looked at it and he said, oh, we have to do this, don't we?
Oh, that must have been a great moment for you.
Yeah, yeah. And then they did it. And then the play made sense to everybody. You know, it was that thing of this, your secrets, that you're as sick as your secrets. And when you, the stuff you've never told anybody, of course, is the stuff that everybody relates to. Viscerally.
This is like the second time in 3 weeks this idea came up. It is the Emerson thing of the private spark. Like when you have that.
Yeah, I guess. It was fascinating to me because it was stuff I was mortified by. Stuff you would never want anyone to know. And since Simon came out, you know, at least 1,000 people have come up to me and said that I saw this scene and I had never told anybody about, you know, and sometimes I'm like, do I need to know this right? but it's
but it must be deeply rewarding to you, man.
It was cathartic to write it, and then so that read through went that night at the West Bank, and some for whatever reason, I don't know if the actors called people. You know, actors are funny. It was standing room only, and it was Frank and Edie in the bar. Many of the guys ended up doing the play on Broadway, and it just played. Like the first act, they couldn't stop laughing, and then the second act, they're laughing, and then they were just completely f***ed up.
Right.
And so I thought, and then again, right away, people were like, this is going to be on, this is 95.
And how did you, so how'd you process?
And they're
that?
Like, this is going right to Broadway. I'm like, yeah. And nothing, again, the 5 years that followed that were the most excruciating 5 years of my life, because I knew I had something, and nobody cared. And the actors knew.
You mean
we had
from
something.
That reading? This is really, yeah. I think. You mean from the? So you make Night. We Never Met. Everyone says you're going to be a star. It doesn't work. You finally you dig in. You write this thing. You have a huge cathartic artistic break. You actually see that you're correct. It plays. The audience freaks out. The actors freak out. And then it's how long before the world recognizes it?
5 years. And it was Bogosian and I are close, Eric Bogosian. He said, watching me during those 5 years, he said it was like watching somebody try to pull a tractor up a muddy hill in his teeth.
Right.
You know, I dug in because I had gotten the monkey off my back. And so in some ways, I was freed. I had written this thing. I had always wanted to be a good writer, and I had written something good. You know, I felt somewhat, and I had, also I'd come to, in the course of writing it, I'd gotten over my childhood. It liberated me that way as well.
It was the thing that we're all artists dream of is that moment. All writers, I've only had that moment happen to me twice where I couldn't write a thing. I was, you know, the movie Solitary Man, I don't know, that movie that Michael Douglas is in. I was stuck for like 2 years at page 60 of that thing.
Right.
And I couldn't, and it was a very personal.
There's usually a reason. You know?
I was writing a personal story, and it was not about me, but there was a reason I was writing it. And then when a series of things happened. I did a series of things to try to break. I started doing stand up. I did all sorts of stuff to try to like shake myself up and find it. You know, and at the same time I was making movies, but I knew this thing was important to me. And when I had sort of like the shift, then it wasn't like in a night, but then in 3 weeks of just working a couple hours a day, the whole, or after 2 years of being blocked, I wrote it. And like you said, the 60 page, so I wrote 60 pages in this like condensed period of time. And that's what, I mean, that's the movie. The movie.
When it happens, and it, you have to grind it out every day. But then there are those days where it just, it, you unblock and it all opens out and it comes out. And so I don't, I never know. Well, that's why you have to kind of write every day, because you don't know when it's all going to happen. But this was because the director said nothing happened. Not, you need something to happen. And I had this cast and people were coming to the read through. And that's the kind of pressure I was used to writing. That's what got me to write it. And so, but from, it took about a year to get New York Stage and Film in Poughkeepsie to agree to give me a production of it. And they had been there, but there were some personal issues there. I can't even begin to describe the, again, politics, and I wasn't very good at it. And there, if there are rings you have to kiss, I never kissed them.
Were you able at that time? Well, why?
I guess I
why does it make you angry to have to do that?
I feel like these people, oftentimes I feel like these people are manipulative and idiots, and I'm embarrassed. I remember meeting Joseph Papp once at some event, and some playwright went up to him and said, "Oh, Mr. Papp, it's such an honor to meet you. My God, everything you've done for New York theater." And I was like rolling my eyes in the back row, making for like, boy, is that guy a kiss ass. That guy's play got done at the Public.
That guy's name is William Shakespeare. David Mamet. That's how I first met David Mamet.
I won't even say who that guy is, but he gets a play done every year in New York. And he looked at a room. And in fact, there was another person at that party who said to me, "You have to look at the room and see who's the most powerful, important person here, and that's the person you have to make sure remembers you by the end of the night." And I thought, my entire life has been the opposite of that. I will talk to the waiter.
I still don't believe people really—I mean, I know people do that, but I still don't believe that people who are really—you know, a person who can do both.
That woman's a producer.
That's a producer who said that to you. Yeah. I believe that.
But that woman wouldn't do my play.
Did that woman ever say I was wrong not to do your play?
No, not to this day, no.
Right. Do you run into her with a big, do you smile big when you see her?
No, we pretend to be polite to each other. Is it because, I feign, but, so I never had that skill set of, you know, my, jazz musicians don't really have to curry favor with anybody. They just show up for their gig, and that, it was not modeled for me. I didn't understand that, and I had no interest in it, and I thought it was, you know, oh, that's your suck up, and you know, you just didn't do that in the neighborhood, and so I unfortunately,
you mean you're real,
I just internalized the life lesson: you can never be perceived as the teacher's pet because you will get clobbered.
Did you carry that with you to Stanford?
Yeah. I didn't talk to professors. I didn't understand that people at Stanford were thinking about what grad... I didn't know what grad school was. I had no idea that there was something after college.
Yeah, some part of you knew, I'm going to go to California, I have this dream.
I was running away from home. Later, when I went to Al-Anon meetings, I picked up some literature on the... I was both the Joker child and the hero child, but the hero child leaves home at an early age, goes far, far away, but does so in a way that brings honor to his family so no one will suspect there's anything wrong. And I thought, 16 full scholarship at Stanford. I read this at like age 30. I thought, why didn't somebody show me this piece of paper at 16? You know, but I was just running away as far as I could go.
And somehow pulled it off. I mean, somehow you were able to pull it off. Isn't that Alice Miller book is about that too?
Yeah, the drama, the child.
Yeah. Is about that idea. And I guess, yeah, you really did personify it. But then, you carry these things, like whatever the things were that you used to get through, like, you know, mocking or not mocking, copying, modeling yourself after you say you didn't have a model, but in fact you did. Unfortunately, it was a useless model.
Well, my
in many
role models
ways.
Were guys who lived to get 13 weeks on the books or 20 weeks on the books so they could collect unemployment. And the whole game... that was their whole life strategy. Get enough weeks on the books so you could collect, and then you work off the books under other people's
names. And
you
admired those guys for some
Those were my role models. Those were the...
musicians.
And they were cool. The other thing is, it takes a while to have perspective on your parents, but my dad and his friends were cool and funny, and they were smoking pot in 1941.
And playing great music.
And they were really good musicians, and it was... boy, it was fun hanging out. But I was hanging out in the clubs with them, you know, very... like, I would go to Jimmy Ryan's and sit at the bar at age 13 and have screwdrivers and watch him play sets. And then this trombone player, piano player, played both, would take me across the street between sets, and he'd have Boilermakers, and I remember my first Boilermaker at like age 13 across the street from Jimmy Ryan's, and then you go back in for the second set. You know, it was so...
You were living the life of a jazz man at 13.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was like, oh, there's Donnie's kid. And I knew the music, and I would, you know, it was, so that, then I got to Stanford, and it was the most boring place on earth.
Right. You were living like a Bugsy Malone existence.
Yeah. I mean, some of these guys had me placing bets for them. They had like bookie accounts, and I was the smart kid. So they had systems, parimutuel systems that they'd bought. And I would like run the systems for him and call the bookies, and you know I was.
And so, when you got to California, I mean, you must have been. There were a lot of things you didn't know that everyone else knew, but there was a ton you knew that you must have seemed like an exotic, incredible.
Well, the weird thing now is when everyone remembers me, and I don't remember. You know, they were all like, they were sort of, they all had BMWs and 10-speed bicycles.
Were you able to talk to the women who looked like you'd hope they'd look when you got
there?
Yeah,
I mean, it was also a complicated place because it was a 2-to-1 male-female ratio, which was a big mistake and sets up a very unhealthy environment. But I had an odd appeal to some women. I was not... a straight shot. But there were women who were, and I didn't understand this, people were going to Stanford like their parents, and they knew this is where they were going to meet their genetically correct spouse. And I'm at Stanford, you're at Stanford, we're Ivy League, we're well-educated, we're handsome, we will meet here and mate and have children. And I would say 60% of the people I was in school with mated there for life. I mean,
And you saw that happening.
I didn't understand what was going on. I was like somebody's little piece on the side, and then I didn't quite get... that they were thinking long-term at Stanford, I was nobody's idea of a good bet.
But to jump up to the present, because the you'd get the Playmade, right? Mm-hmm. And it becomes this...
Well, we do it in Poughkeepsie one summer, and the limos are coming up to Poughkeepsie, and people are like, where can we make dinner reservations? I'm like, there's a Domino's.
Right.
And it plays unbelievably well in Poughkeepsie, and it sells out... But to me, the greatest moment of my life as a writer was we'd spent 3 weeks rehearsing it and in a hot, unair-conditioned gym, and then we bring in the designers to see it. And so it's Neil Patel was the set designer. And
these are the people who are going to bring it to Broadway?
No, this is just to do it in Poughkeepsie for 10 days.
Okay.
But they're professional. They're I don't know them too well. Tom Broker, the costumes, very good guys. And so this is the first day you've been alone in this gym working on this play for 3 weeks. And it was a very collaborative environment, very, right. Which is what I like. And the design team comes in, and a few of the other actors and writers come in to see, like, it's like before the first dress, before you go to the stage. You're just in a gym, and there's tape on the floor and fake props. And something had happened in that 3 weeks in that gym. We were so caught up in it, we didn't realize it. And they came in, and it was done. And
wow.
So you had that moment. That was, like, the greatest moment I ever had as a writer.
I mean, I see you're getting emotional remembering it.
It was a big deal. Something had happened there. And we killed in Poughkeepsie, and then it got turned down by every theater in New York for the night. They all came up, and it was like jazz. Basically, it was like jazz don't sell. Can you make them black? Because they're jazz musicians, and we'd love to have a black play this year. And, you know, part of the play was about white jazz musicians who were considered sort of... do you want to talk about outsiders?
Right.
So
you heard nothing but no.
It was dead. It got turned down by the Roundabout, Manhattan Theater Club.
These are my favorite stories because, you know, and if anyone is listening who's has any artistic aspirations, the gatekeepers almost never know. They're always reacting to what last year's thing was.
I really did not like, and I'd say to the discredit of the New York Theater community, the same people who were the gatekeepers then, there has been no turnover whatsoever.
They're actually the same gatekeepers. It's not just that they're all the same. They're actually the same.
It's been now 17 years. Not one of those people has left office, and that's horrible.
So how did you break through?
There was a guy at Poughkeepsie. Everything was bizarre. There was a guy at Poughkeepsie who got mad at New York Stage and Film. Oh, they weren't going to do my play there because they were doing something else, but they had the rights to it. So this guy waited for the rights to expire, and he said, would you mind if I shopped it around? I was like, good luck. I don't know. It seems hopeless.
And what were you doing? Were you writing for TV?
No, I wasn't writing on TV.
Your next play?
I was writing movies that weren't getting made.
Right.
But I was getting paid to write movies that weren't getting made. And we lucked into, there was a guy who had a foundation that he'd inherited, a theater foundation. He was a theatrical lawyer named Jay Harris. And essentially, his foundation had to produce something every few years or they lost their nonprofit status. Mostly the foundation, I think, was a slush fund, so he'd go to England and see plays.
Yeah.
But they had to, and he happened to like jazz, so he gave us a 17-day off-Broadway letter of agreement production on 13th Street. And it was like, it was Michael Mayer and I were taking furniture out of dumpsters in the East Village and putting it on stage. And that furniture ended up on the set on Broadway 3 years after that. But we, so we had our shot and every actor came back. It was, what I had was, that play changed everyone's life who was in it. So we were all, they all just showed up again and we did it there. And I think no one had any expectations. It was going to be 17 nights.
At least you were playing off Broadway.
Off. It was a 300-seat theater, but in order to pay the actors as little as they wanted to pay them, they cut off with curtains 200 of the 100 seats.
So you had 200 of the 300, so you had 100.
We had 100 seats. It was very intimate. It was five rows deep, 20 across.
And this was the first proper production.
This was the first New York production. No first-tier critics, you know, it wasn't Ben Brantley.
Right.
What saved my life is it wasn't Ben Brantley, it was Peter Marks. Peter Marks comes in from the New York Times. Everybody comes for the critics' night. And it was, you know, amateur night in terms of props and set and design. It was threadbare. But I think they came in, it was a lousy night in a lousy theater with no expectations. And that really worked in my favor. It's the opposite of the Night We Never Met experience. They came in expecting nothing. The reviews came out, and my then girlfriend said, "Oh, your life will never be the same."
Ah, this time she was right.
Yeah, that was the only time someone said that when they were right. The reviews were ridiculous, but something was happening in that theater. It was almost a spiritual experience for people in there. It was very. Edie Falco had a mental breakdown every night. She didn't know how to technically get there in those days, so she just went there.
It just happened.
She just fell apart in the second act, and it was riveting and horrifying. And you knew you were watching an actor who was going insane to portray insanity.
You're 40 years old at this time?
Yeah, I guess so.
You're like a 40-year-old man.
With my first play in New York.
With your first play, finally, that you've put your entire life into, and you have these 17 days, and the critics freak out.
And then, at the end of the 17 days, that Jay Harris guy says, you've had a success d'esteem. There's, you know, your next play will be read by every theater in the country. This is it.
That's it?
Yeah. And by the way, the 100 seats were sold out immediately.
And you know this is the most magic. You mean, you know even then,
And I was correct. I said, I will never see reviews like this again in my life. Because the expectations were so low that they...
Yes, it was a great story and a great story. It was like, you were a great story and
yeah,
it was a great story.
And the performances and the... And he's like, we're done.
Play.
And I, by the way, when it was run, I said, now that these reviews are here, do you want to take away those curtains and sell 300 seats? And he goes, no, we'd have to pay the actors $25 a week more.
Because it's a bigger theater.
Yeah. So that was his, he had a kind of a shtetl mentality about this whole thing. So it's dead. Michael Mayer and I look at it, and Michael Mayer goes, this is the story of my life. Because he said, it's just, this. It's over, honey. That's when I dug in. That's when I really dug in. And we got a lucky break. The Roundabout, which had earlier turned it down, was bringing in a big musical for the summer, like a Barry Manilow musical or something like that. And it was coming from San Diego, where it received the worst reviews of any play in the history of musical theater. Somebody actually wrote something like, I'd rather take lint out of my cuffs than sit through this again. So he had his big end-of-season slot at his stage, Todd Hames, and they had nothing. And they had worked with Michael, and they knew him. They brought it to the Roundabout.
It's a very esteemed theater.
And it was a big house, and the critics came back. And by then, the play had deepened. It had run 17 nights. The actors had gotten better. I mean, they were the night the critics came, every one of them flopped on some level. Everyone in that play was like a jazz musician. They had been booking gigs, and were, you know, I mean, honestly, nobody had. The number of checks I ended up picking up when I didn't have... it was a real threadbare group. And they knew that the critics were there and they had a bad night, but the reviews were still good. So when the critics came back and now they owned this play, the reviews got even better. And we had this triumphant summer run at the Roundabout. And I'm like, are we going to move it? And once again, everyone's like, the same guy said, your play has been seen by everybody who's going to see it. And Christian Slater had seen it. And he said, you know, if you ever do this play again, I wouldn't mind being the narrator, the Warren character. And so we tell the producer that. He says, I don't want you talking to him. Because right now everybody's at Favored Nations and they're all at scale. And you'd have to pay him more. So we immediately went to lunch with Christian Slater.
Of course,
Joe
Allen. Yeah, I hope so.
And we said he doesn't want to do this. And he goes, I'll make what everybody else makes. I'll go. I just want to do this. And so again, sort of, and then a theater opened up. But it was.
Did you allow yourself when you had finally the run at the Roundabout? Did you allow yourself to enjoy that time?
It was hard. It was still the sad thing about this, not too terribly sad, was that it was a struggle every day because the wrong people were producing them. So the guy didn't. When the Roundabout says we want to do this play, Jay Harris says I don't want to give it to them because it'll be a Roundabout production, not a Jay Harris production. And the only reason he agreed was his ex-wife, who was also in theater, ran into him on the street and said, I'm so jealous of you. I've been struggling in theater for all these years. You do one play and now it's going in the Roundabout. So his desire to
stick it to his ex-wife
was why he acquiesced and allowed the Roundabout. And it was filled with these moments, the entire run of people finding reasons to say no and getting in the way and having to orchestrate politically. And I mean, I did start to develop some chops as a result of this. And now I can function in the world
producing
of NBC and
chops,
Dick Wolf.
Yeah.
I was essentially producing then.
And when it finally did make the leap, you got Christian and it went to Broadway.
Then it was still a struggle getting people to come. But it was great to have a hit play. It wasn't doing great box office, but just to have a play on Broadway, and every night I'd go up and watch. And by then the director's gone. Directors leave.
Yeah, you know, and you're there.
You're the mommy of the play, essentially, and the directors are the dad. And, you know, the ushers were and we had a great run, and then we got a Tony nomination, and then the producers said, we'd like to close the play. We're not making enough. We can't keep the play running long enough for the Tonys. And one producer, Ron Kastner, at that point, very good guy, stepped up and said, I'll write a check to cover the next 4 weeks.
I'll float us through the Tonys.
I'll float us through the Tonys on the condition that I get paid back if it does well. I said, fine. And the play ran through the Tonys and won the Tony, I think, to the shock of...
Well, you won the Tony for Best Play.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was great, right?
Yeah, and that was...
I remember being at home watching and cheering. I never watched... You know, I'm not a big theater,
I had never watched the Tonys in my life.
I cheered so much the night that you won that. I just thought it was just incredible.
And, you know, these guys had all stayed with the play a lot. But it was just this weird... The play almost closed 3 weeks before the Tonys, in which case it would not have won because nobody votes for a closed play.
So you have this moment. I mean, this is what I was thinking about walking here today. So you have this moment. You fought like, you know, you really fought like a heavyweight too.
You punched way above my weight class, yes.
And you got this thing to happen and you win the Tony Award, right? And I know you wrote other plays.
Yeah.
But it seems to me, and I don't know if it was a decision or you'll say, I can tell that you're going to say none of this was pre-planned. You fell into it. But in a way you've... you know, you've become, I mean, you run a gigantic franchise.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
And it's a franchise that is the hallmark of which is not the personal stamp of the writers writing the shows. It's a factory of some sort. Now, I can watch your episodes and I can pick out that now you write with a partner, but I can pick out themes. I do think that it's interesting. You like making fun of a certain class of people in New York.
Yes, I do. I do enjoy that.
I mean, the last episode of Criminal Intent that you wrote is about wine snobs.
Yes, not a successful episode, but I loved. I mean, we do. I think the audience likes it too. You know, you don't want to. I'm on SVU now. I actually feel we're turning out 24 episodes a year, which is insane. But there is. I don't hold anything back. Any personal story, any incident in my life that will help a story out,
I can tell. I can tell that you care passionately about the show. I can tell because you're very active on Twitter about it. You love the fact that it has.
You have to be invested. You can't do this if you're not.
You love the fact that. But you watched the first episode you wrote of SVU, and it's about, again, a guy. It's about a man in power who's holding himself out to be, I mean, it's his kid, but mm-hmm. who's holding himself out to be the elite. And you have a kid in there who was kicked out of this ritzy environment and who ends up taking the fall, who does the thing. And it's like you've somehow found a way to get themes that matter to you into the show.
Right. Yeah.
But what's the story you tell yourself about the choice you've made?
Oh, well, it was strange to me. So I had a big Broadway success. And the people who turned the play down were still snotty to me. There's an artistic director who says, I never liked the play and I still don't like it. I don't care if it won the Tony. I love that. It was a very... The theater world, I found it to be a very closed shop, right? I didn't...
You still didn't think you belonged, even after you won the Tony.
I knew I didn't belong. It was made clear to me I didn't belong. Right. So I kept writing plays. And then one of the actors in Simon said, oh, Sidney Lumet wants to know if you'll do an episode of 100 Center Street. And I thought, Sidney Lumet? Yeah, sure. And then my agent and lawyer said, you can't do that. That you can't do a TV thing right now. And I said, well, it's Sidney Lumet. It might be kind of fun. I did it, and my lawyer fired me. And I liked it. It was fun. But that was the first TV thing I had done. And around that time, I was dealing with enormous elder care issues. I had my mother, my father, and my father's twin all at the end of their lives, all penniless, all in varying stages of bad health.
And you needed to manage it.
I was on duty. That's when my hair went gray. And I used to look so young. I'll show my hair to the audience now. But I had 5 years of...
It's still a beautiful head of hair.
I'm very happy about that. It's one of the few things that worked out, I think.
It's like William Devane's hair on...
Not William Devane. So I was just besieged. I'm hemorrhaging money. I'm supporting my mother and my father and my uncle. And the theater world is being pissy. And I write one episode of TV. And then I had never watched a Law and Order in my life. I had not watched an hour-long drama since I was 12. Right. I was a sitcom watcher, if any, but I hadn't watched TV. I get a call. There's a show. Law and Order is looking for a writer. Do you want to meet with them? And I said, "Where is that in New York or L.A.? I mean, I didn't. What channel is it on? I didn't know a thing about it." And they said, "Isn't that a law show?" And they go, "This is a detective one." And I go, "There's more than one." I mean, I was
that's great
a moron. And they said it's a detective thing. And I said, I looked at one. I said, "Send me every one they've done." And I didn't understand television that how many people in TV get these jobs and then figure out the show. I thought I had to come in, so I stayed up all night. I watched 20 of these episodes of D'Onofrio, and I came in with a full 5-act storyline, figured out what he was doing, and the guy just looked at me and he was like, "Well, when can you start?" And I didn't realize that I'm amazed when people come in and meet with me now and they haven't even watched.
They haven't even watched the show.
Yeah, they don't know Maloney's gone, and I'm like,
I went on a binge just to have this conversation.
Yeah, well, you either prepare or you don't.
Right.
While I was waiting for my theater career to just reignite, and I kept working on that and working that, I inadvertently took this job, and I wrote one episode, and then they put me on staff as a writer. And it was the thing I wasn't paying any... I was doing my work, but I had no awareness of television at that point. And I just did it. It was a nice $30,000 paycheck to write an episode, and then they asked for another, and then they put me on. And it turns out in TV, if you can do it, they throw the work at you. And if you can do it fast, there didn't seem to be that class system that I'd encountered in theater.
And you found it satisfying to do?
I was on set. I was casting. It was everything I had been doing in theater for 25 years, except that instead of the 5-year wait to get my play on, I was writing things. Then he had me rewriting everybody. I was writing things, and they were shooting them the next day. And I was saying, what about so-and-so? What about so-and-so? Can we bring in... And I was, and this particular showrunner, who's a very good writer, Rene Balsay, had no interest in production. So I knew how to talk to designers and how to talk to, I knew how to, the other thing was, Warren knows how to talk to actors.
Yes.
Which to them was sort of, first of all, something nobody wants to ever do. And it's a mysterious process. And Warren seems to know how to talk to them and calm them down. And we had...
You can make them laugh.
I can make them laugh. And I can try and see what's going on with them. Oh, is this what's, is this the line that's bothering you? And when you get it right, it's like taking the thorn out of there. But they're like, oh, thank you. You know, and D'Onofrio was not easy.
Yeah, right. Though great on the show.
Great on the show. Demanding, difficult guy. And you better know why you wrote something, you know.
Because he's going to pick it up.
Yeah. And actually,
so you and... You go ahead.
I did not enjoy that. Because it was... Actually, that was reminiscent of my childhood. That almost got to this... There was an... whether intentional or not, there was a bullying quality to working with him that I didn't care for. But he was, you know... But then it would happen when you said action. I no longer think that's worth it to me professionally. I would not go back to that kind of relationship. I have learned a few things.
On a movie, every sin that they commit during shooting, if I'm in the editing room and they've given us the best part of themselves, I'm fine. I'll pay the price almost every time.
Yeah,
but it's different than on a television show
where
you have to be with them for a very long time.
Television and marriage. Movie is a fling.
Yeah. As soon as you're in the editing room and you see that what they gave you, I forget it's the childbirth. I forget how difficult.
Yeah. No, that doesn't... Television, working with, say, Mariska, who's the number one on our call.
Which is a dream for you, right?
She's just the most energetic, generous, lovely, thoughtful, and she's present and she leads. You don't want a toxic set. And I want an asshole free zone. I don't want anybody pulling rank. I don't want anyone being abusive. This is the lesson of my child. I can no longer tolerate abuse. I don't like being abused, and I don't like watching anyone abuse anyone on my crew or cast.
So that's a lesson from your childhood.
Yeah, and that took a while.
And then
I used to think I can handle this. People would complain about people. I'd go, you think you've had it bad. I've worked with so... And I would brag about it. Like, that's a good thing.
And now you
thing.
Don't want to brag about it.
Yeah, I mean, I started to get jobs after that because I got known as the diva whisperer.
Right.
But what happened, they just kept throwing work at me because I could do it quickly and I knew how to function on my feet. And I could rewrite overnight.
But how have you... So now that you, through your hard work and doing it well... You know, you're in charge of this. One show, and now you're in charge of this other giant enterprise.
Right.
And, I mean, you are in a way. You don't wear suits, but you are a guy now who runs everything.
Yeah, it's weird.
How do you reconcile? I mean, how do you deal? Are you comfortable with it? Have you made yourself comfortable with it?
It turns out I know what I'm doing in this job.
Right.
And I have and I put together a team of people and we respect each other. And every 8 days, what we pull off is something somewhat astounding. You know, it's 7 days to prep one of these things and 8 days to shoot them. And while you're prepping one, you're shooting one and breaking the story for the one two away and rewriting the one that's going to start prepping and you're editing. Yesterday, I worked on 6 episodes, 2 edits. The one that's prepping, the ones that's shooting, the one that is supposed to be ready to prep in 4 days. And plotting the one after that.
That's a showrunner's job, which I don't know if people are aware of how hard and...
I don't think people have any idea what a showrunner does.
I mean, how many hours a day are you working?
It's better now. On In Treatment or Lights Out, I was putting in 100-hour weeks back to back to back to back. I've learned some aspects. I'm not great at delegating on the writing side. It doesn't seem to be my strongest suit. But I trust my production team implicitly, and I have a very...
So you don't live in the editing room anymore?
No. I mean, but the editing is a process, and I love that process.
You're down to 80 hours a week?
I'm probably down to 70.
That's reasonable.
That's okay.
In that job?
I mean, depending on the week. There are weeks where it's only 55, and then there are weeks where, you know, your head explodes.
And then just a couple more things, and then we can finish up. And are you comfortable, and this is a weird question, I know, but someone from your entire life experience who didn't make really any consistent money until you were older... Are you comfortable with the idea of financial security? Can you understand it?
I think here's how I still malfunction. I pick up every dinner check. I'm aware.
Let's go to dinner.
On me. I cannot let somebody else pick up. Because I remember all those times I was working with rich guys and they split the check.
Uh-huh.
Charles Strauss.
Great.
I remember all of those moments, and so I'm aware of that. You can see I haven't spent it all on
clothes.
We rent our apartment.
Now this is getting to be a crazy pathology.
No, but it's not. It's not like Gil Gottfried territory. So we have a very nice second home out of the city, which means the world to me. But I probably have the real estate I passed up on. I probably clutched a little bit at the thought of what I like, having grown up with the finance people calling, and you know, Warren, if they call and I'm not here, do not let them talk to your father, like those kind of things. I want a cushion. I'm not a big. There's two ways to go from that childhood.
Yeah.
And I went the more
secure.
Yeah.
And now you're raising kids in a secure environment. So you've given that. Lastly, and we haven't. So two things. One, quickly, just a quick thing. Where do you rank Dolan on the list of all-time bad guys? Like, for instance,
fascinating.
If Hitler is Michael Jordan, Idi Amin is Larry Bird of bad guys. Mm-hmm. Alex Rodriguez is Alex Rodriguez.
Yeah, I think that works.
Where is James Dolan?
Well, he's almost like those King. Who's that guy? King Ludwig, who would sit on the balcony and for fun, like shoot peasants.
Yeah.
Like
the guy in Schindler's List who would do that.
You know, it's less funny because of the time issues. But it's an insane despot, and a lot of these guys are. So you have sociopaths, you have psychopaths, and then you have someone like Dolan who is, I would say, probably just crazy. Having written in Treatment, I don't know that he's a I think he's just, he's whimsical.
When you watch him, Bill Simmons on Grantland posted yesterday in his mailbag a shot of Dolan and his, what's the band? Dolan and his band. Doing an acoustic number, like in.
I'm
some,
saying Hitler never had a band.
Book that he painted. he had a band, very band of painters that he was. So you would put him sub Hitler.
Yeah.
Not as bad as Hitler. I agree. I want you to know that I agree.
Not as bad. He's not. I don't perceive him as evil. I perceive him as monumentally incompetent. To me, who are the leaders who are the sons of evil
George
potentates?
Bush.
Yes.
I don't think Senior was evil, but Junior.
Junior. I would say you're into George Bush or the new guy in Korea who doesn't look good at the start. Yeah, right.
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-2 or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's the guy.
I think that's
the factor, is that he inherited all of this, so he thinks he's accomplished something. So, of course, these are the guys I went to Stanford with, just to bring that back. So they're the guys who really believe, because of their prenatal foresight, that they own Comcast and the Knicks. They are unaware of the damage they're doing.
I think that that's true, and they don't understand that when they're there playing their acoustic guitar and trying to be out there, how we watch that, what we see that as.
Well, yes. And now, going back to my jazz dad, one of the most horrifying things for these guys, they get booked to do a private party at a rich guy's house, as it was always called, some rich guy, and the guy thinks he can play.
He wants to sit in.
And they have to let him sit in. And they have to, because the guys paid for them. And I cannot tell you how little respect they had for those guys, and how I can't even, on a podcast, say the words they would say to describe these guys. You can't even on a podcast use that kind of language.
Because those are the worst guys. Dilettantes who don't even have any respect for what your dad and those guys lived.
Yeah, so the...
Well, you're a guy who can swing. And what's great when I came back and watched all your shows...
Jesus.
Is that you've actually gotten back at a lot of these people in your work. You rip them apart. I understand. And the next time we do this again or have dinner, we can talk about Lights Out, which Levine, my partner, watched and loved at the time. And I didn't watch. But now, having watched it, I totally get why you loved it.
I loved the music of Lights Out. And I thought Lights Out, again, I thought, okay, this is going to be mine for the next 7 years. I have found what I should be doing. And everyone was... And
you feel that when you watch it, by the way, even though just the one...
And that cast was... That was the closest thing since Sideman. And oddly, I came back reluctantly to SVU, and it turned into something much more than I expected.
Have you thought about putting Holt on the show at all?
Yeah, I have had help.
Oh, have you had him on?
I've had everyone from Lights On.
Oh, that's great.
That's
because Holt fits in that universe.
Yeah, I had him in as the dad of a victim who basically got revenge.
Did you write that episode?
As the showrunner, you more or less write or plot or rewrite every word of every episode.
But your name's on them because you really wrote them from soup to nuts, right?
Yes, but you must. It's a hard thing. Everybody contributes, but there's. When a script comes in after you've broken every beat of it with the writer, somewhere between 50 and 100% of it gets rewritten by me and Julie.
You and Julie write most of the dialogue.
Some people can write dialogue, can't write story. It's a very complicated process. And the speed with which we have to turn things around and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite.
You can't explain it. You have to do it. Okay, yeah. Lastly, I want to just say this, and I said this in the introduction, which is that if my moment professionally is the thing that finally, when I turned 30, made me... become a writer and break through, there are little things that happen along the way that contributed to me going, I have to do this. And so the way you and I met, Warren, when I was really a kid, I was working in the music business.
Right.
And we were, the company had decided to do the soundtrack for The Night We Never Met. Yeah. And they sent me to the editing room to talk to you. Because, you could talk to actors, I could talk
you
to
could
creative
talk,
people,
yeah.
you know. And I went to the editing room and spent a day with you going through it. And in that moment of being in the editing room and watching you talk to the editor and talk about music and show me the thing and talk about talking to the actors, I think in my mind I'd always carried the idea that somebody who could direct something or write something was entirely made of a different species, the way that you viewed those Stanford people. But when I met you, I knew we were kindred in some way. Mm-hmm. And I knew that this was possible. And it was an enormous moment for me. It took me years after that to do it. But it was one of the things that I filed into my head was, that guy Warren Light figured out how to do this. And I understood him. And I saw how smart you were, and I knew it took me a long time to be able to really do what you did. But there was something about being there that just felt right for me. And the first time I was ever there, it was because of you. So it was really, you never know the unintended consequences that you have. But you were so cool to me and so welcoming, even though I was just a suit from the record company who didn't matter. But you embraced me and made me feel really good about being there and about whatever I thought about the music. And it was instrumental in some way in me knowing, as crazy as the idea was, that I was going to change my life and become a screenwriter and a director. You know what? It's not impossible. So thanks for that.
Oh, well, that's nice to hear. But as you can see, I botched my relationship with Harvey, but I was open to you, and that's...
There you go.
I'm glad it worked out.
Hey, man, there's so much more we can talk about. I really appreciate your time.
Very nice
to
see you.
I have to get back to working 70 hours a week. So thanks, and I'll talk to you soon.
Really nice to see you. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Grantland. To hear more Grantland shows in your earballs, subscribe to Grantland Sports and Grantland Pop Culture on iTunes. Or go to grantland.com and click on Podcasts.